Hey, I'm Scott. Thanks for listening to episode 2 of You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle, a podcast where my co-host Jamie and I pair movies with wines and then talk about them. Our first 5 episodes are a fun time capsule from late 2020, way back before we picked a name for the show. So please enjoy several very dated jokes about that. Also, me recommending a new movie that has now been available for 3 months, and Jamie's passionate pitch that you all buy a calendar. Please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find the show, and follow us on social media at Bigger Bottle Pod. Cheers. Sommelier.
I really don't care how you pronounce it, honestly.
Are either of those correct?
I say sommelier.
Sommelier.
Yeah, that's how I refer to myself.
Is that like an anglicized version of the French, right? Like you swallow the L's, basically?
If you want to be all fucking French about it, it's sommelier.
Ça, oui, sommelier.
Yeah.
Mise en scène.
But let's introduce the show. Scott, who the hell are you?
Hi, I'm Scott. Prior to the pandemic, I ran movie theaters and a film festival in Philadelphia for about 10 years. And now movie theaters are fucked and I am currently out of work. And thus I do what out of work people is and we start podcasts.
Yeah.
Also, I'm a full-time dad. Jamie, what's up? How was your industry devastated by our global pandemic nightmare?
So I'm Jamie, and I've been in Philadelphia restaurants, Philadelphia and area restaurants for in excess of 10 years. Similarly to the entertainment industry, the restaurant industry is big fucked.
I ain't working. He ain't working. We're staying home. You should be staying home. Hopefully you are staying at home and listening to this in podcast radio land. But I pass the time in the quarantines by watching a lot of movies. James passes his time in the quarantines by drinking wine to excess. And here we are, bridging our shared passions with a podcast, at present still unnamed as of the time of this recording, where we will tell you things that you should watch that probably went under your radar, and Jamie will recommend a bottle of wine to pair with it, and we will discuss. Welcome.
So, as we begin this podcast, let's start, Scotty Tuhati, with the movie that you chose. Give us a little brief lead-in, and then tell us what you told me about this movie in order for me to pair wine with it.
So, as anyone who listened to our previous episode all the way through to the end on Marriage Story would know, this week we watched Dick Johnson is Dead, which is a new 2020 documentary from documentarian Kristen Johnson, in which she trains her camera on her dad. Dick Johnson is a retired psychiatrist who is, at the beginning of the movie, suffering from the early stages of dementia. The Johnsons team up and they're going to document Dick's transition from living on his own on the West Coast to moving into Kirsten's one-bedroom New York apartment, while simultaneously the two of them with a team of, like, filmmakers and documentarians stage a series of deadly accidents that befall poor Dick or his stuntman stand-in. And they also stage a fake funeral, some heavily stylized dreams, and also 2 music videos of Dick's arrival in heaven. In the movie, both of the Johnsons struggle with the blurred line between artifice and reality as Dick's condition worsens in front of us.
Okay, I've got some questions. First of all, her name is Kirsten, right? Not Kristen.
Kirsten, not Kristen.
Yes.
Kirsten Johnson.
Kirsten Johnson.
On a very long podcast interview I listened to with her, which I'll talk about a bunch, she frequently refers to herself as KJ, which I'm going to struggle, or I'm going to resist the urge to do that because it's convenient, because I don't know her and I should not refer to her by a nickname.
But also because that's
Kirsten Johnson.
That's a popular moniker for a wine that is not well loved by the cognoscenti of the wine community, Kendall Jackson.
Kendall Jackson. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with them. There's some kind of...
They call that KJ.
Animal on their label? There's no animal?
Just, they've got like a family crest.
Is it like a house?
Kind of situation.
Family crest.
Yeah.
They're a pretty large producer, right?
Yeah, their wine is bad. They're big. They're one of the largest family-owned companies in the world. They're not publicly traded.
Anyway, what I gave James... to spur him on creatively for a pairing for this movie.
James is not my name.
I told him that the film was... James is your name. I told him the film was warm, dreamy, introspective, and I believe I told you it was glittery. Or did I say sparkly? I forget which one.
Sparkly.
I think I said glittery.
You said sparkly.
And based on that wealth of information, Jamie, what have you paired with Dick Johnson is Dead?
All right, so we've got Riesling from the Mosel River Valley of Germany. This is from a producer named Julian Hart. Julian's first vintage was 2010, released in 2011. So young guy, but a really kind of exacting winemaker. This is the 1,000-liter cuvée, as we mentioned. It just says 1,000L on the front label with sort of a florid kind of gilding on there. And that refers to the vessel it was made in, which is a traditional 1,000-liter barrel called a fooder. And this is a wine that's made specifically for the American market. It is, the whole fooder is purchased by Von Boden, who is the importer, and it is then distributed around the country. This is what I think Julian would refer to as the entry level of his wines. It doesn't have any specific vineyards or ripeness level indicated. It's just Riesling.
What were the two things that made this entry level?
It has no single vineyard designated, nor does it have a ripeness level designated.
Okay, so no single vineyard designated. Like, I get that. It means that the grapes can come from any number of places. Is that the idea?
Correct, yeah. A single vineyard would indicate, like, think of these are like just the... Basically, the point here is that the more specific it is, likely the more expensive it will be.
Fair. Okay. And that's a tremendous segue. How expensive is this bottle of wine for people in these United States?
$21.
$21.
That's correct. Plus shipping coming from Crush Wine Co. in New York City, but they ship nationally.
That's great.
This is the entry-level wine at 21 retail. The wines that are what you might call Grand Cru, and I'm using air quotes because that's a legally controlled term in France, but it is broadly applied to the rest of the world because it's sort of an easy concept to understand. Just like the best place to grow a grape. Mm. Julian's wines go up to like $40, $50.
Well, let's get into it. Let's get into this motion picture.
This hell of a motion picture. Well, let's start here really quick.
Yeah.
I would like to say for the record that I felt this movie was emotionally devastating. It was, in a lot of ways, a really hard pill to swallow. It's gorgeous, but it personally hit me hard. And I find it difficult to see how it wouldn't hit another person hard. Scotty has another opinion.
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, I don't think it's unemotional. It's an extremely emotional movie, and it's raw, and the characters, your subjects, are extremely vulnerable. But I also find it's all of that heaviness about dementia and dying and, you know, preparing for your death and preparing for a parent's death and all these major, like, life upheavals that these two people are going through. It's leavened. It's leavened by other things. Like, I think it's leavened by, obviously, a lot of humor. I found it to be not laugh out loud funny, but it is definitely wry and knowing, and when the staging of all of his various deaths can be very slapsticky. I don't know, you're 3 minutes into the movie and we see him get hit by an air conditioner, or so we think.
Yes.
Like an air conditioner falling from somebody's window sill. Like, the movie is telling you pretty early on. Like, it opens with this very sensitive scene. She is filming Dick and I think it's her two kids, and they're playing in like a barn with a rope swing, and Dick is trying to push the one kid and she's worried he's going to fall, and then he does, and she's very anxious about it, as we're going to very quickly find out, like, why she's worried about her dad's health so much.
But not so worried that she comes out from behind the camera.
Well, so that's one of the other things that I find so interesting about the movie, that this is going to sound super boring and pretentious. I find its intellectual rigor offsets the emotional turmoil that it puts the audience through. Like, I find it to be so thoughtful about its subject matter that I think the movie is more about some of the intellectual questions about ethics and documentaries, for example, or the blurred line between constructed, like, narrative artifice and just what we think of as a documentary, which is just like raw, you know, unvarnished, unfiltered reality. I find all of that draws your attention away from the sadness.
Well, first of all, I would like to say that your preface there that it was going to sound pretentious is absolutely true. It did.
It was completely correct. Yeah.
You were absolutely right in assessing what you just said.
Yeah. We just lost half of our audience. Four people just switched off the podcast. Well, when I said intellectual rigor.
And now we're just screaming into the void, which is basically what we came here to do anyway. But
Right, exactly.
I think that intellectual rigor is what makes it harder for me.
interesting.
You're watching this woman try to process, like, her grief is quite literally on screen. Her, like, she's going through the stages of grief as this movie goes on. She's watching her father
die. And he's not even dead yet.
And she knows how it's all going to end because it has happened to her mother before.
Right.
She's applying her profession. The total weight of her intellect and her abilities to her grief, and watching her do that is, for me, completely devastating.
I obviously don't dismiss your experience. Like, that's the movies. That's the great thing about them, right? We can have such radically different experiences of a thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we come at it from different backgrounds as far as the subject matter. Like, I have not lost a parent. You have lost a parent. So, like, your perspective is obviously weighted there.
It for sure is.
Right at the top of the movie, after that opening scene, she comes in with a bit of voiceover. But now it's upon us, the beginning of his disappearance, and we're not accepting it. He's a psychiatrist. I'm a camera person. I suggested we make a movie about him dying. He said yes. And then, like, you have title card. It's conspiratorial, which is what cued me in the beginning, that there is a playful tone and a playful mind behind this movie. There, she's letting you in on the gag, and she makes you complicit right away with that in the beginning. She's telling you, like, we're going to stage a series of gags, and it's going to be silly and morbid, and we're going to confront death head on and laugh about it. We're going to make it entertaining, which is for your benefit. Because, like, for as much as this is a deeply personal movie for this one filmmaker to process something that's happening in her family, she makes it entertaining for an audience. Like, that's why you stage musical numbers, or why you stage his death multiple times and have stunt people come in. Like, you do those things to entertain the audience that you're engaging.
Right, but
which makes us just as complicit in this, like, weird ethical blurring about, like, depicting his death over and over again. We're a part of it.
Yeah. And doesn't that feel a little weird, especially when you're watching this guy die?
Yeah.
But putting his death into the context of an air conditioner falling on his head or falling down the stairs. It's her wishing that he went those ways as opposed to the way he's going.
Is that what you think it is? You think it's like wish fulfillment? Like, she would rather he go in some swift, banal accident than...
Yeah, and as a person who watched a parent die in a long, long way...
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I would have preferred something more abrupt.
I wanna get back to this ethical question, because I think it's, like, so core to the movie. I think her background is fascinating, and it would give you a lot of context on the film.
Because I'm interested to hear this. I didn't do much research.
So this is only her second feature as a director,
huh?
But she has been a documentary camera operator for over 30 years. She shot for like some of the best documentarians, like, on the planet. And also some of the most controversial. She was a camera operator on Fahrenheit 9/11. The Michael Moore movie.
Got it.
She shot for three of Kirby Dick's movies, the best known of which is probably This Film Is Not Yet Rated, the documentary about the MPAA ratings board.
Yep.
She was one of the camera operators on that. And she shot, I think it's three of Laura Poitras' films. Laura Poitras, who is a documentarian who has spent the better part of the last, God, like 20 years documenting the rise of the surveillance state and the increased surveillance apparatus at after 9/11. So she shot on The Oath. Which is, I think, the first thing that Johnson shot for Poitras. She was also one of the camera operators on Citizen 4, which is her outstanding documentary about Ed Snowden, which is still great despite all the Glenn Greenwald in it. So her first film as a director was in 2016, and it's this documentary called Camera Person, and it is made up entirely of footage that she shot for other people's documentaries. It brings the presence and the eye and the mind of the camera operator and the agency of a camera operator to the foreground. And so even though she barely appears on screen in that movie, you get a sense of who she is and how she feels and thinks about things by what she points the camera at, what she says off screen, and how those ideas are all strung together. That's a hell of a movie. It's currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, and you can VOD rent it any number of places. It was one of the most talked about movies of that year in film circles. Got nominated for Best Doc at the Independent Spirit Awards.
Probably doesn't have that wide of appeal. It's a little bit niche.
The thing with this movie that she continues, like, thematically from Camera Person is this idea of undercutting the dramatic artifice of documentary.
Well, and here's...
Documentaries are not just reality assembled, like, they're put together by someone.
Right, but that's once again, and I'm gonna try not to harp on this too much, because obviously, like, I've got some dead person drama in my past, but, like, watching someone trying to, exactly what you just said, undercut the dramatic artifice while viewing a thing that is inherently dramatic on a very personal level, she's trying so desperately to separate herself from the grief while she's actually putting herself into it. I personally very much empathize with her here, you know, like, fucking, what did I do around the time that my mother was dying? I threw myself into work.
Right.
And here she is doing exactly the fucking same thing, except her escape brought her closer to the thing, which is a really, really interesting fucking thing.
And that was part of her goal with this project, was to not just process her grief or her pre-grief for what her dad is going through and what the family's about to experience, but also to just get a ton of footage of him because she didn't have any.
And I'm not saying that that choice is necessarily wrong, because she made a beautiful thing. And in the end, I think it's pretty obvious that, like, unless she did some incredible work in the cutting room, Dick is very, very happy to have spent this time with his daughter.
There's a really good interview with her in Rolling Stone from their critic, David Fear. And he asked her, how hard did you have to pitch Dick on this idea? And the answer is, I'm reading a quote here from her, not hard at all. The question was, Dad, can I film you being killed over and over again? Sure, honey, anything for you. She said, he got it right away. The thing with my dad is he's a pretty humble guy. He just wants to be remembered by his family and friends. The death parts, which are funny, that he got. The parts where I was just filming him around his old house or in my apartment or walking around. What, you just want to film me eating soup and baking a cake? He couldn't figure out why that was interesting. He has no hubris, but I do think he's someone who's always looking for a laugh. So yeah, he seemed to get an awful lot out of the experience, even though it must have been grueling. Like, it, we've talked so much about what her perspective must have been like during the experience, but, like, for him, like, this is a man of he's a man who has dignity, right? Like, he raised a family, he suffered a tragic loss of a spouse, he's been a psychiatrist for decades, and now he's retired, and not only is his mind going away.
Not just retired, it's really important to, I think it's really important to say, forced into retirement. It's made clear in her voiceover that he began double booking clients, that his secretary reached out to her and her brothers, and they ignored warning signs up until the point where they had to pull the trigger and he had to relinquish his practice.
But yeah, I mean, his perspective in the movie is so interesting to watch throughout. And it's something that is also very much constructed in the filming and in the editing. But, like, this version of Dick Johnson that comes through, like, he seems like a very sweet and decent and warm and generous man with a great sense of humor. He's dealing with, like, so much all at once. Like, his career has ended. He went from living on his own with all of his autonomy to now moving into, like, a small one bedroom place of his daughter's. He's moved across the country and now he doesn't have a car anymore and he can't be trusted with this and with that. And all these fucking cameras are pointed in the face the whole time, which is extremely invasive. And we're staging his death over and over again. And then she wants to get introspective with him. And anytime the waterworks turn on and they both start getting understandably upset, there's also a camera there.
Yep.
Like, I can't imagine being the subject of that process.
I think the best sort of illustration, and it comes very early in the movie, of, like, of his generous spirit and of his general motivation as they're describing Kirsten's upbringing as a Seventh-day Adventist, which isn't ever, like, fully unpacked.
It's unpacked a bit. There's a couple of mentions of the church and specifically their vision of the afterlife.
There are, but I, like, if they had said Catholic, I would have felt like it was adequately explored. But Seventh-day Adventist is a little intense to be as small a factor as I feel that it was. It's a religion that demands a lot of its congregants, and I think it's interesting how little it's talked about, even though it is talked about. But anyway, during that discussion, Dick says, I've got my heaven right here on earth with all of you. That sort of sums up the character the characterization, rather, of Dick Johnson. He just wants to be with his people, his family, his congregation, his friends, and he wants them to be happy.
Yeah. And he seems extremely content here in, like, the physical material world as well. Like, the number of times that we see Dick Johnson eat a, like, pornographically photographed chocolate cake.
Made me want some chocolate cake. He is a man of
earthly pleasures. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did.
They made chocolate cake twice in that movie, and both times I was, like, compelled to go down to my kitchen and begin making a chocolate cake.
And just make cake.
Also, chocolate ice cream. He loves chocolate ice cream, and...
The man loves chocolate.
In a close-up on a bowl of chocolate ice cream, his voiceover goes, "Life is good."
Life is good. But, like, what little they do talk about Seventh-day Adventism in the movie, in the way that it's really relevant, is about the afterlife, which is so important to the scenes... I guess we should say, for people who haven't actually watched the movie yet, which is like, what are you doing? You should stop listening to this and go watch it. It's 90 minutes. You probably had Netflix. It's great.
I'd like to amend that. Don't stop listening to this. Absolutely continue listening to this. Hit the subscribe button and then go watch the movie.
All right, fine. You fucking marketing hack.
Listen, I'm just out here hoeing. That's what I'm here to do.
You are out here hoeing. All day, air day. You are out here hoeing. But so they talk about the Seventh-day Adventist very specific version of an afterlife and the idea of heaven comes about and when everyone is risen, right? So the Seventh-day Adventist
the idea is that everyone who's dead is in some sort of like a suspended animation. I think it's described in scripture as slumber, in that sect as slumber. And then when the apocalypse happens, that's when Jesus returns. Everyone, the faithful are resurrected and go to heaven.
They ascend all together.
And of course, there's no mention about what happens to the unfaithful, but that's not important for the confines of this movie.
I'm really proud of you for skipping an opportunity to be shitty about religion, Jamie. This is growth for you, and I approve.
Just for the record, I don't subscribe. I smash the unsubscribe button.
Right. That's good. Their version of an afterlife is important because it is staged for Dick, for the movie. We have two scenes, two different scenes, one of which is a gorgeous, hypnotic, like slow motion montage, seemingly of Dick arriving in heaven for the first time. And there's a model or an actress wearing like a huge black and white photo mock-up mask of his deceased wife. And there's glitter falling everywhere. And there are dancers. And there's a Jesus. What is Jesus doing? There's one really funny bit that Jesus is doing at one point.
The one thing that Dick is insecure about in his whole life, or rather we're led to believe in this movie, are his feet. He's got deformed toes that kind of stick up and they look weird.
Yeah.
So there's a brief moment where Kirsten is telling him that she's going to use movie magic to give him regular feet. And then they show you that it's like, it's this foot washing sequence, which is very referential of the Bible, in which Jesus is washing Dick's feet and they change from malformed into what we know is somebody else's feet, but into regular looking feet.
The staging of those two scenes. And then there is another scene that is filmed in that heaven set, which is much more like a music video. It's like it's poppy, up-tempo music, and Dick and the model wearing the mask of his late wife are both dancing. It's all super high energy. Jamie, what do you think of all the stagings? Because mostly what we've talked about has been like the subject matter of the movie and the emotional life, but we haven't talked about all of the like high production value, like fantasy scenes and all of his deaths that have been staged.
The one that hit me the hardest was the him being lost on Halloween scene. Because that was fucking intense. And I can't even imagine, honestly, taking a step back from the movie and trying to imagine her conceiving of that scene after that event happened and putting him into it. It feels not great. And it feels like one of those moments where she pokes through it where like the idea of her filmmaker persona kind of took over.
So for the listener, again, if you haven't seen the movie or maybe you don't remember, and it's Halloween and the family is all out trick-or-treating, and we find out that they went to visit somebody's house and they left Dick behind while the kids went out to go get candy from somewhere else. And Dick got confused and disoriented.
And yeah, Dick had no idea where he was, and he decides that he's going to leave, and he ends up getting lost. And they end up finding him.
Right.
But there's like a moment that, like, he comes back on camera, and he's in the car, him and Kirsten, and she's explaining to him what happened, because right. he was having an episode of some sort and sort of blacked it out.
But then sometime later, they stage a recreation of him being disoriented in this strange person's apartment. It has the look of like the cabinet of Dr. Cagliari.
Totally.
Which is like crazy extreme production values where all the sets and the backdrops are obviously sets and backdrops, and like the doors are all at weird angles, and none of it is meant to look like reality. It's meant to suggest what you're feeling.
And there are like a lot of doors, and it looks very confusing and disorienting, and he opens a door yeah. and it like opens into what looks to be a nursing home, and it seems to like just filming that scene seems to have taken a toll on him.
Yeah. So this is something she talked about a lot in some of the press for the movie. The ethics of it in terms of being a documentarian and what we portray, but also the ethics of him being her father and her now being his caretaker. She says, he kept saying, I'd do anything for you. And then as his daughter and as a filmmaker, I can't exploit that. I can't. I purposely left in those moments in the film because I wanted to own up to that.
Yeah, one is towards the end where she's talking specifically about it and about him.
Yeah.
About basically exactly what you just said. Which is, he would do anything for her, and that's now right. her responsibility. I mean, just like when she has him on camera as he's realizing that his car is being sold.
And that comes right after we see him drive the car. Like he's leaving his office for the last time. It's a convertible. He's got the top down. He's having a great time driving. And then cut to the two of them in a room. And he's like, what do you mean I'm not going to be able to drive again?
I'm trying not to place a judgment on it. I know that I'm sounding like I'm saying that all of these things that she's doing are bad. I don't necessarily think that. However, there is absolutely damage done to both herself and to her ailing, dying father. Her camera added to the pain. If her camera wasn't in the room when they were talking about his car being taken away, it would have hurt less.
You think?
Absolutely, with 100% certainty.
Why? Why would it hurt less?
Because an intimate moment with sapped of its like literal intimacy hurts more. Because we change what we observe.
Yes, but it's not like there's a third party in the room, right? Like it's her with a camera. He's known her entire life. She's a filmmaker in her 40s or 50s.
You've made movies. Don't fucking camera. Don't act like a camera is not a third party.
I mean, it can be, but I don't know. If you've raised a filmmaker and a documentarian and she's always got a camera on her, I at a certain point you get used to it. You get used to the camera being in the room. What you said about it absolutely does harm. Here's my question for you. Do those scenes where she has the camera present and she's recording or where they're staging things that are upsetting to him, is that doing harm, or are we meant to perceive that harm has been done? Like, let me give you a good example. So one of the deaths of Dick Johnson that is staged in the movie is Dick falling down on the street, right? Dick is walking down the street. He loses his balance. He is, unbeknownst in theory to the audience, subbed out for a stunt person. And then the stunt person collapses and takes a horrible fall.
Yeah.
Except the first time we see that scene, we don't see it from the cinema camera's point of view, right? We don't see it from the staged camera's point of view. We see it from the documentary crew filming. That is, I think, the first time that we don't see the staging first, or we don't see the staged death first. We see the actual staging. She wants you to pay attention to the process, how Dick experiences it, how she experiences it. We watch that whole gag get pulled out. You watch her giving him direction, directing the stuntman with a hand on the camera operator's shoulder to guide them where to go. She physically executes the Texas switch. A Texas switch is when, on camera or just off camera during a take, you switch out an actor for a stunt person. So like maybe the actor dips below frame during a fight and then a stunt person comes back up and then the next hit knocks them through like a glass window, right? But you do it all within a take. They just hop off camera.
Why do you call it a Texas switch?
I have no idea, but that's what it's called. It's called a Texas switch. But so anyway, so that whole staged sequence, it is more important for her that we watch them doing this, that we watch them staging the death, than it is for us to see it the way that they're staging it. And that's so much about like what you're critical of the movie for, which is like this perceived callousness. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like that she doesn't put down the camera to be a sensitive daughter, right?
Yeah.
Like the camera's always rolling, but that's what the movie is talking about. Like the movie is in conversation with you as the audience. And there are times when you want her to put the camera down. There are times when she does. There's a scene in his house while the two of them are packing up and she just puts the camera down on some ugly ass shag carpet
and it just rolls for
like 2 minutes and we just get the audio. I read in an interview with her that was not an intentional thing. That was just like, we're both still wired up with mics. Like, I'm just going to put the camera down because my dad needs a hug and we're just going to use the footage,
which is great.
And her collaboration with her editor was like bringing all of that into it.
Great that you did it like then,
but she does do it. She does it repeatedly throughout the movie.
But she also repeatedly is on set with him dealing with other things. Meanwhile, he's flirting with the boom operator while she's dealing with the stunt guy. That is,
it's her job, man. Like it's her job. It's,
bro, I know, but. Holy, like, not that these are colossal sins, but you brought this man to New York City to be closer to you. And once again, as someone who has experienced this kind of grief, I'm going to go ahead and guess that Kirsten Johnson, Johnston. We're both now having trouble with her name. Now I'm going to blame the wine.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess that she's going to have some level of regret once he's gone.
I mean, they spent a hell of a lot of time together. This movie was filmed over like 3.5-4 years.
Yeah.
She filmed a bunch of other projects in the meantime. Like, it's not like
it's an incredible opportunity to be able to do that with your dad.
Well, yeah. I mean, the project did literally like brought them into proximity. They spent time together. And the stuff that you're talking about where like where she is on camera, but also you have to assume off camera navigating all of these things. And like she includes a few moments, which I think cue us into her intentions. Like, I don't know if she looks back on this movie with regret. It's weird. I so often try to avoid like psychoanalyzing filmmakers because I'm shit at it.
And it's also impossible because everything is raw on screen. Like you're talking about the grieving process literally and figuratively. Her psyche is just as much on display as his. If not more. I think I'm coming off like I'm being critical of her taking advantage of him. And yeah, I do feel a little bit that way. But really, my position here is it's not about coercing him into doing things or not taking care of him properly, as in the Halloween scene or whatever. It's in not giving herself the genuine time with him that she would want to remember in the future.
We obviously... This is a movie that has stirred up a pretty interesting and intense conversation in us. What do you think, though? Like, I don't really have an assessment from you. Do you like it? Would you recommend it to other people? I am for one toe thumb up. Are you two toe thumbs up?
Well, I think it's very, very important to say that only one of us has a toe thumb, and it's me. You're the guy over there with two normal thumbs, and I've got one normal thumb and one toe thumb.
Two normal thumbs, baby.
And yeah, I like this movie. I like it a lot. I love that there's so much to dig into. How do I put this? I feel like someone without a film background and whose parents are both alive might struggle with this movie.
You don't think it's accessible?
Correct.
Interesting. Because for all my talk about like, you know, constructed artifice and intellectual rigor and other bullshit, I find it very accessible. Like it's certainly not a straight down the middle movie, but like it's personal, it's human. It is at times very funny. It is at other times very emotional. At times great to look at. It's short. It has big ideas. It's relatable. Like I would think it's accessible, but I have also struggled at times to convey my thoughts about something's accessibility to the norms.
Yeah, and same. I have that problem too. I think that's probably why we're podcasting together.
We both love the movie. I think that's the big takeaway here. We're both unreservedly recommending the movie, and we both think it's great, and no one has any qualms or grievances with it.
I have both.
Would you concur?
I have both qualms and grievances.
Podcast title, Qualms and Grievances.
That's actually...
It's not the worst suggestion we've had so far, Qualms and Grievances.
My name's Jamie, he's Scott, and this is Qualms and Grievances.
No, it's, my name's Qualms, he's Grievances. Well, that I think that wraps up, at least for now, our discussion of Dick Johnson is Dead. Jamie, tell me about this wine that I'm drinking. I have my notes here from when I drank some last night.
Yeah, so
I'd like to share with you my thoughts, but you tell me some stuff.
No. Before I get all like monologue-y about where this wine comes from and who the producer is and blah 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 blah, why don't you tell me what your initial impressions of the wine were?
Yes. So, the Julian Hart 1,000 liters Riesling. My initial thoughts. Sweet. It is a sweet wine.
He's looking at me asking for approval here, and I'm not going to give him an up or a down until I get into this.
I'm not going to be validated. I detected notes of vanilla and honey on the nose. It actually reminds me of what my wife and I call our house white, which is the Barton and Gustier Vouvray. We always keep a couple of bottles stocked here. It's like $13, and it's super tasty, and this reminded me a lot of that. But pineapple, I believe the palate detected pineapple, and also little bit of mandarin oranges. That was the last flavor
mandarin
note that I detected.
I love
canned,
the specific,
like dull, like in the syrup mandarin oranges.
Hell yeah. Love it. Did you like it?
No, I do. I really like it. It's very tasty. It's, I think, of the two wines, the three wines that we've talked about so far in this podcast, depending on if we consider our early pilot canonical, this is certainly my favorite so far.
This wine comes to us from the Mosel Valley,
which is in Germany.
Yeah. Das ist der Mont. Yeah?
Yeah.
I just used the entirely wrong word. I used the French word for Germany while trying to speak French. German. I've had too much to drink.
Uh-huh.
The producer's name is Julian Hart. Julian's first vintage, as I said at the beginning, was 2010. He was mentored by Egon Müller and Peter Klaus Keller. These are two of the best producers of Riesling. Egon Müller comes from also the Mosel Valley. And then Keller is widely regarded as the best producer in the Rhinehessen, which is farther south, is a much larger wine region. You looked like you had a question there.
It was going to be to ask you what the Rhinehessen is.
The Rhinehessen is another wine region of Germany. It falls farther south on the Rhine River, and it has for some time been sort of synonymous with bulk wine production, although Keller and a number of other producers are doing their fair best to change that.
The Rhinehessen.
Yeah, the Rhinehessen.
I don't want to make any broadly, you know, stereotypical generalizing jokes about German people like 80 years after World War II, but like that's something someone shouts before they're ordering the Blitz, right? Rhinehessen.
Basically every German word sounds like that to me.
That's fair.
So some of the vineyards that Julian purchased in his early career, the first one was called Olisberg, which doesn't necessarily...
Olisberg?
Olisberg. O-H-L-I-S.
Olisberg.
Yeah, Olisberg.
Not to be confused with Otisberg, the portion of the West Coast that is promised to Ned Beatty by Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor in 1978 Superman the movie.
Not to be confused with that. I don't know from where you pulled that arcane bit of knowledge, but I'd
Otisberg, he puts it on the map when Lex is explaining the evil plan to Superman. Because it's
actually
all about real estate. Land, 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 land.
Episode ever.
Hey man, at least my shirts cover my belly button, okay? That's a dig on the comic book guy and not Jamie.
They usually cover your belly button.
Well, anyway. it's been a rough quarantine, okay, pal?
Me too, man. Me too. I put on that COVID-19, you know, just trying to slim it down at this point, but I'm failing miserably.
Yeah.
All right, well, so he bought these vineyards.
I prefer you fat anyway.
You fucking dick.
I do. I liked you better when you were fat, okay? I'm sorry. I like you fine now. I just think we were closer when you were fat.
We were also in like a pretty abusive relationship when I was fat.
I don't recall any of that.
That's because you're dumb.
And selective in my memory.
Yes. So, as I was saying about young Julian Hart, he purchased Olisberg in a town called Peasport. He's also got parts of the Goldtropkin Vineyard and Schubert's Lay. This is all to say that he's got some really, really great vineyards under his umbrella. And he has topped out at about 4 hectares, which is about 10 acres. And that's sort of where he intends to stay. It's the amount of land that he can work sort of just alone, him and his wife, and not have to bring in a whole lot of extra help. And he can sort of do do things the way he wants to do things.
Tell me about that grape. Tell me about that Riesling.
Yeah, let's talk about Riesling. Riesling is the most planted grape in Germany. Everyone thinks of Riesling as sweet. When you say, I've got a really nice Riesling for you, people can sometimes get real uppity and upset. They're like, I don't want anything sweet, even if you're talking about...
When you say people, who are these people?
The fucking guests in my restaurants.
Okay.
Well, restaurants that once were managed by me that now are not anymore.
Because you can still be a little possessive. I'll always think of Micah as your restaurant.
Oh, man, I miss that place.
Me too. You know what else I miss? Restaurants. Also things. I miss things. Going to them. Experiencing them.
Hold on. Do you remember bars? Bars were great.
I have a vague recollection of them. I've also been a dad for several years, so it's been a little bit longer since I've been a regular on the bar scene than it has been for you. But yes, I am aware of bars. I am aware of getting drinks with people.
Also, do you remember hugging people?
Well, I mean, I have a family. We're very affectionate. There's lots of hugs, but other people
like hugging a colleague.
Yeah.
That was a whole other... Anyway, we're just... Now I'm going to start crying. We were talking about dead parents before, and I was fine, but...
But now hugging colleagues is the thing that puts you over the edge. Jesus, Jamie, you really are a workaholic. Hang on. Let me go to everybody's favorite recurring segment of this podcast that we've recorded two episodes of so far, and at present no one has listened to.
I hate this.
Favorite recurring segment, Jamie tries to guess the primary flavors... in winefolly.com's profile of Riesling.
Okay.
Five primary flavors.
I'm going to go with lemon, lime, peach, slate, and lilies.
What do lilies taste like?
Smell like. They smell
like
lilies.
I said flavors, not nosal profile.
Well, now we're getting into... deep conversation about olfactory profiles and the fact that our tongue is only capable of tasting something like 40 flavors, but there are, I think I actually just saw an article yesterday putting the theoretical cap of possible aromas detectable by the human nose somewhere in the six figures.
Oh my God. So the tongue can detect 40 flavors.
Yeah.
This is 40 beyond what the five or six base flavors like sweet and salty and fat and umami.
Including those, like these are all combinations of those.
And the schnuffer can pick up hundreds of thousands of them.
It's why if you were to hold your nose and taste this wine, it would seem completely different than when you're just tasting it with your nose available, or like when you're sick and your nose is stuffed up, you can't taste anything.
Well. On winefolly.com, head-to-head, Jamie versus website.
Her name is Madeline Plouquet, by the way, the woman who puts together this website.
So, Jamie said, lemon, lime, peach, slate, and lilies. Do we have lemon? No. No lemon on the board. Do we have lime? Lime is on the board. I'm going to drop this Price is Right thing because I don't have it. Oh, Family Feud. That's what it is. Family Feud.
Yeah, it's Family Feud.
Lime is on the board. So they've got lime. They do not have peach or slate, which is very strange because, again, if my... imperfect mechanism can detect slate, then how can winefolly.com not detect it? And you said lilies, no lilies. So the only thing you got is lime. Up here as well, she lists green apple, beeswax, jasmine, and somebody's pulling my fucking leg because there's a little clip art here of a gas tank and it says petroleum.
Is that
actually a thing? This is not just this website breaking my balls here.
No, that's a thing. And it's probably, honestly, anyone out there who knows me and or who knows wine probably would have said petrol, and I did not think of it as a... because I don't think this wine is showing any at all. But it is a classic aroma of Riesling.
Now, Jamie, my siphoning gas tanks days are long behind me. It's been a while since I've consumed any petroleum products that I'm aware of, that I've consumed any gasoline, but why would one want to taste that in their wine?
You probably wouldn't. It's typically an indication that the wine you're drinking is too young and needs more time aging. The petrol character typically blows off after time. And if it, you know, if you're drinking a young Riesling and it's very present and you find it unpleasant, decant the wine and it'll be fine.
Pro tip. I like that.
So before we got caught up in this wine folly nonsense,
which is funny and is sweeping the nation.
Anyway, so there's Riesling is like the Somme grape. If you ask 100 Somms what their favorite grape is, 75 of them will say Riesling.
Interesting. Why is that?
Partly because Riesling is legitimately a great grape. It is extraordinarily expressive of the place that it is grown, and we're all very obsessed with a sense of place. I think that there's like a legitimate reason to love Riesling. The other part of it is, as Somms, we spend our days tasting a lot. And a lot of what we taste is like big, full, tannic red wine, because that's what most people like to drink. When you've gone to a portfolio tasting, and let's just say hypothetically, you've tasted 100 different Cabernets, the only wine that's going to be okay after all of that is something that is screamingly high acid, bright, crisp, and maybe with a little bit of sugar to it to like clean your palate off. And that's what Riesling does. Riesling can be at once thoughtful and gluggable in a way that I don't think that very, very few grapes can be.
Now, Jamie, you're throwing out some pretty technical terminology. Now, I've been like around gluggable? You long enough. I've picked up some of the key ones. I know what gluggable means. What is a thoughtful wine?
A thoughtful wine is a wine that gives you pause. You swirl it, you smell it, and there's so much there that you take a moment before you taste it. And then you sit there and you think about it. You say, like, what are the elements of this wine that speak to where it is rather than who made it and vice versa? And it's the difference between something simple and something complicated. It's the difference between...
Yeah, put it in my language.
Say, Jaws and Dick Johnson is dead. Not that there's nothing to think about when it comes to Jaws.
Right.
Because there
Jaws,
is.
Jaws, which is, I mean, many things can be viewed through this prism, but Jaws is, I think, the quintessential 2020 pandemic film, but go on. Extremely thoughtful movie. So dense with layers that it projected layers forward, you know, 45 years.
But it's actually not, it's not that dense with layers. It's very surface level. It gives you everything on the top.
I think a lot of the action is happening beneath the surface.
Shut the fuck up.
God, that was good, right?
I hated that.
Yeah.
I hated that so much.
No, but I understand what you're saying. Something that is populist and accessible and bright, and all the flavors are very direct as compared to something that, what, you have to, like, your palate knows conference has to team up and have a sidebar, and you have to parse the flavors and the notes. Is that the idea?
And there are things that are both, which Riesling frequently is, and I'd say something like, I don't know, Star Trek, in all of its glory, can be both.
Yeah. Is still pop entertainment, but it's got a brain to it.
Exactly. And you can choose to engage with the brain or not.
That's true. You can't watch Dick Johnson is Dead and not engage with it emotionally and intellectually, right? Like you,
it's
that
impossible.
Movie is not.
And I think that's why I chose this wine, or one of the reasons. Because like you told me that this was going to be about parental death. And I was like, okay, so we need something that people can escape into their glass for a moment and not be bothered with, like, trouble. This wine is just, this is happy juice. It's like, it's got a little bit of sugar to it. I wouldn't call it sweet, but that little bit of sugar just puts a smile on your face. Like the screaming acidity makes you want to eat something. The real, like, high-toned fruit flavors, that, like, lemon, lime, peach, pineapple.
Mandarin orange.
Canned mandarin orange, sure.
That is no less absurd than, you know, 90% of the ways that you have described wines to me in the past.
No, it's not absurd. And I agree with you that it's there. But I think that that's more of a background player. I get, like, fresh lime juice, and there's almost a little bit of a salinity to this wine, too. It's like, it's got kind of a margarita quality to it.
Mm. So that's the other thing. This is something my wife and I talked about. I wonder, because I do not have a refined palate or nose, like she would say something, or like you just said, margarita, right, with the salinity, like the lemon and the salinity to it. And all of a sudden I can detect that. But like, am I just like a wine hypochondriac? Like, is it entirely the power of suggestion that enables me to detect something, or has it been there the whole time and now I have the words for it?
I would argue that it's the latter. Having gone through wine education and been an educator for some time, there were moments when I felt exactly like you. Like, I'm sitting there being talked at by a supposed wine expert telling me that a wine tastes like, you know, those like candy peach rings that you find everywhere?
Yeah.
Someone saying that they get that in a wine, me going, that's bullshit. Then putting my nose in the glass going, oh my God, it's actually there. Did I just get fooled?
That is a nasty candy, by the way. Sidebar, candied peach rings, pretty gross. Super disgusting.
You don't like peach rings?
These are the ones where it's like a jellied peach ring, and then like on the other side, there's almost like a white, like frosted thing or something on it. Are we talking about the same candy?
Yeah, we're talking about exactly the same candy, and they're covered in sugar.
Gross.
Love peach rings. Oh, man.
I also have strong feelings about non-chocolate candy, though, which is why. Why do, like, I'm very much, it's something I thought about watching the movie last night, like, oh, Dick Johnson, if I live to being in my mid-80s, I'm gonna be like you. Someone's gonna give me a plaque that said, like, this dumb motherfucker ate an entire cake and then the next day had a heart attack. Not to say that Dick Johnson's a dumb motherfucker. I am the dumb motherfucker.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, I love chocolate as much as the next guy, but, like, sweet tarts? Love sweet tarts.
Nope. Nope. That is garbage filling your trick-or-treat bag, okay, buddy?
Sour Patch Kids? Love Sour Patch Kids.
Sour candy is gross.
Gobstoppers? Oh, my God.
Gross.
And just like your basic gummy bear. Gummy bears are wonderful.
Gummies are fine.
So a couple of other things to say about where it comes from, about the grape. Obviously, Riesling is sort of third in line when people talk about the most terroir-expressive grapes. And I have qualms and grievances when it comes to the concept of terroir.
Why? And your beef is just that it sounds like you take it very literally, right? Like,
it's not just that I take it literally. It's that winemakers, wine marketers, sommeliers, and consumers take it literally. As though Dr. Luzin, Bernkastler, whatever, is an expression of that grape, of that place, and nothing else could be. As though Chateau Montelena, Cabernet Sauvignon, is an expression of that place, and nothing else could be. Well, history has shown us that that's not entirely true, and Cabernet hasn't historically been the only thing planted there.
Is that the idea of terroir? That not just that you can sense the place in the consumption, but that a place can only be good for one thing?
I guess the marketing concept is that a place can only be good for one thing.
Ah, okay.
Riesling, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay are probably the three that'll come to top of mind when anyone talks about the transparency of terroir. That these grapes have an ability to translate the place that they're grown in a way that other grapes don't. And I can't disagree. They're typically difficult to grow grapes. They are all very difficult to grow well, and when they grow well, they taste incredibly different depending on where they come from. You're giving me that look, that like dumb look, that look
no,
on your face
just,
that is dumb.
I have nothing thoughtful, insightful, inquisitive, or funny to say in response to that. I don't really understand what you just said. I don't have questions about what you just said. And I don't understand it enough to make jokes about what you just said.
Okay.
So that is my dumb, blank, cow-eyed look. Let me pose a question to you.
Yeah.
What foods would you pair with this wine specifically? And then we should talk about whether it pairs to the movie or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, traditional things that you might cook in your own house, like a sort of a meatier fish, something a little bit fatty, something like salmon or monkfish.
Monkfish.
Yeah, I haven't had a good monkfish in some time.
It's kind of a funky fish, but I like monkfish.
Yeah, the oilier and fattier, the better.
Catfish?
Catfish would be great.
Yeah, I can actually imagine that. Drinking a swig of this after a bite of, like, some, like, really nice, like, seasoned Maybe not deep fried, but just some nice
even deep fried. Deep fried would be great.
Catfish.
Like the fattier the better, because the acid in this cuts fat, and the acidity on this wine is fucking outstanding. So like shellfish too, like a scallop, like a really big sea scallop would be super yummy, as well as clams. Like even the funkier, more like salty, weird, like big ass cherry stones fried on a po' boy would be lovely. The other thing that I love Riesling for, and this always like is counterintuitive for a lot of people, is steak.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Right? That's unconventional.
But I challenge you to try it. And maybe not exactly this wine, but like particularly old Mosel Riesling, there's something about that amount of sugar, like a Spätlese or an Auslese with a ribeye that has so much fat to it, that's just beautiful. It's just gorgeous. So I love steak, but like a lean steak with this would be really great. Like a filet would be super yummy. Any raw fish, raw beef also. I would stay away from salads with vinaigrette dressings because like that's just too much acidity. But right. That's another reason why Somm's like Riesling is we can buy it for our wine programs and then pair it with basically everything. Because I just like blurted out a number of things that this pairs with.
Yeah, you just said like 3/4 of the menu, basically.
Exactly. And there is no one really in the world who would disagree with me. Like this wine pairs with so much. It's very easy. It's a good fallback. If someone's being difficult about a pairing, you can be like, Riesling is gonna work. Because it just kind of works. And does it pair with the movie? Fucking yeah.
I think it does. You know what this wine is? This wine is all of the comedically staged scenes, right? This wine is Dick getting hit on the head with an air conditioner. This wine is Dick looking on in like awe as fucking appropriately brown looking Jesus like washes his newly restored feet.
Yep. This wine is her giving him the direction to like move his arm while like the blood packet is bleeding out after he fell down the stairs.
That is maybe my favorite moment in the whole movie. Where yeah, we've done the first scene in heaven. They're beautiful, glittery, slow motion, like shallow depth of field, soft focus version of heaven, and then cut back to Dick fake collapse down a flight of stairs, bleeding out, and you hold on this long like 7 or 8 seconds of just the blood pool expanding, and then her from off camera, Dad, can you just put your hand up on the wall? Like it kind of, and then he just does it. And then we go back to silence.
Yeah.
It's just so funny. And it's the entire movie in a nutshell. It's great. But yeah, this movie is that, like you said, it's the sweetness and the joy to like, it's the thing that you cut away from for the misery, right? It's
when you say it like that, it sounds particularly German.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. Yeah, I really like it. I had a great time drinking it last night. If my speech is as slurred as I fear it is right now, I've obviously had a great time drinking it this afternoon. Yeah, it's real yummy. It's super tasty. And thoughtful, apparently. It's thoughtful.
There's a lot to it. I don't want to fucking defend the idea of thoughtfulness too much, but like you got slate from it. There is an impression of minerality. There is an impression of earthiness. There's florality. There's fruit. There's a lot to it.
It's complex, but still very enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm real happy that we drank this wine.
Me too.
I honestly wish I had another bottle. I would open a second bottle right now. All right. So we've gotten through the movie and the wine. Scotty, what do you have on deck for this week? Anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, one of my favorite movies of the whole year just came out on Amazon Prime Video. We will probably do an episode on it at some point, but someone pointed out to me that our first two episodes were, in the parlance of my wife, Stone Cold Mega Bummers, and that maybe we should kind of lighten up a little bit. The movie is called Sound of Metal. I saw it as part of Philadelphia Film Festival, their virtual festival this year.
You have recommended this to me.
It's so good. It just came out in early December on Prime. It's a first-time feature filmmaker. The director's name is Darius Marder. It stars Riz Ahmed. He plays a drummer, like a metal drummer, who is right at the beginning of the movie starts to show signs that his hearing is deteriorating. It is so beautiful and intimate, and this Riz Ahmed performance is unreal good. Like, it's got to be the best performance I've seen all year. I loved it. Sound of Metal on the Amazon Prime. We will probably eventually discuss it at some point. So check it out. It's great.
Dope. I'm excited for that.
Jamie, what are you drinking this week?
So I'm probably going to be pimping out the Finger Lakes a bunch, partly because I love it, also partly because I was up there and forged some amazing relationships over the harvest this year. But the thing that I wanted to shout out right this moment, some wonderful winemakers, some of whom I call friends, have come together and made a calendar, a 2021 calendar called FLX Posure. That's FLXPOSURE, and that can be found at FLXPOSURE.org. It's a burlesque calendar shoot of Finger Lakes winemakers.
Yes, it is. Wow.
It is sometimes sexy, sometimes funny, all the time both. It also benefits COVID relief food banks all over New York State. So grab the calendar and also take note of the wineries that these people work at, because they are all producing world-class wines.
I am looking at the website and some of the photos right now. This is great. It is very cheeky and very funny and, yeah, occasionally very sexy. And this is delightful. Cool. This is charming. I like it. FLXPOSURE.org. Check that calendar out. Good choice, James.
Yeah.
So we should tell the cats and kittens at home what they should be watching and drinking in advance of our next episode.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Scotty Too Hottie, what have you chosen next time?
Well, having fielded, again, some criticism that my selections have been really heavy so far, and I'm sure I will go back and listen to this episode and realize I did not make much of a defense of Dick Johnson Is Dead as being funny, though I find it funny.
Yeah, shit's fucking heavy, dog.
Yeah, and then he's bleeding out after he goes to heaven, and she says, can you move your arm higher up the wall? That's funny.
It is funny. I'm not saying it's not funny, but I am saying it's fucking heavy.
It is heavy. Anyway, in light of that, I have opted to go in the furthest possible direction from heaviness, from gravity, from substance, and from complexity for next week's episode in this podcast, in which we highlight things that have been overlooked by people and not seen nearly enough. We are watching 2018's billion-dollar worldwide global franchise launching hit, James Wan's Aquaman, a movie that I will stand for the rest of time and will defend. Honestly, the reason that we're watching Aquaman is that I have yet to speak to anyone who did not see the movie, who didn't also assume that it was stupid and terrible. And the thing that they're wrong about is that it's not terrible, it's great. But it is extremely stupid. It's big and it's dumb and it's loud and it's desperate to entertain you and it's mostly very successful and I love it and I want to talk about it and I want to make you jump through hoops trying to fucking find wine to pair with a movie in which an octopus plays drums.
Shit's easy, dog. It's super All right. easy. All right, so wine pairing. This is Denny Binney is the producer coming out of Lombardy. We're drinking Lambrusco next week. A little bubbly red.
Lambrusco. A bubbly red. I figured there were going to be bubbles.
There will be bubbles.
Watching Aquaman is like the equivalent of, I don't know, like ordering shitty fried chicken when you're hungover. Like,
fuck,
it's
yeah.
Salt and starch and fat and all that good stuff. Like, it is exactly what your body needs when your body is unable to process anything else.
Yep.
Whenever we talk about fried chicken or pairings, you're always like, oh yeah, fried chicken, you have to pair that with champagne.
This is correct.
So I thought there'd be bubbles. And it's also a fairly effervescent movie.
Yeah, honestly, if we had something like in our price range for this show, if champagne was available, I might have gone with champagne. But to be honest, I think Lambrusco is a better... You can get thoughtful about Lambrusco, but you probably shouldn't. You should probably just fucking drink it.
So I have two questions for you. One, what should people expect to pay?
This one, if I'm recalling correctly, is like 18, maybe as high as 23 United States dollars.
And then the second question is just for clarity, because you mentioned champagne, and I know this is very controversial, so I want you to clear it up once and for all.
Fucker.
Champagne refers to any sparkling white wine, no matter where it comes from, right?
I'll kill you.
Okay.
Condescending piece of shit.
Next time on Unnamed Wine and Movie Pairing Podcast featuring Scott and Jamie.
Qualms and grievances.
Watch Aquaman, 2018's Aquaman. And Jamie, what are they drinking? One more time.
Denny Binney Lambrusco. It is not vintage. It just like, just get any Lambrusco except for Riuniti.
All right. Good talking with you, James. Everybody, we'll see you guys here next time, and we'll talk about Aquaman. I swear, don't write this off. This is going to be a fun conversation.
Hell yeah.
Good night and Godspeed.
Bye.